share with you my story. Would you share your dollar with me?
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. It's 12:08. I'm John Williams. We'll take a look at all sorts of business information for you in this hour today. And we start with John Najarian, the founder of MarketRebellion.com, the financial news, education, and subscription site, MarketRebellion.com. Hi, John. Welcome back.
Thank you very much, John. Great to be with you.
Let's jump on a couple of the stocks that are popping and getting some attention today. Tesla's in there. Walmart's in there. Kodak and Apple. Where do you want to start today?
Wow, probably Tesla, just because after that 4-for-1 stock split, the stock was just on fire yesterday, and obviously today they came up with that $8 billion unique way, John, because unique is something that is common with Elon Musk, but his unique way of raising $5 billion isn't through a regular share offering. It's going to be basically placement of a private offering. That's what it amounts to anyway, but this stock has been all over the place. I think it's had a $60 range already during the pre-market and regular session today.
What's the difference between a private and a public offering? The stock is not available to everybody?
Right. That is correct. He has signed on with some banks to basically place, if you will, which is very similar to when somebody wants to let loose a block of stock. They will, rather than having a time frame on it, they'll have a price or a range, and they'll say, here is what I would like to do. I would like to sell this many dollars worth of stock or this many shares worth of stock, depending which way they do it. And that is a lot closer to what these guys are doing right now. It's not going to be offered to the public. It's going to be placed more or less as most of a block. And obviously at 508, that was the price they were looking at. Initially, the stock surged to 531 in the pre-market, but right now it's 482. So, like I say, it gives you an idea of the range we're looking at. And Mr. Musk briefly was the third richest man on the planet. Now he's slipped back down to number four.
Is Tesla a safe stock then? It's not like its technology is so out there that the whole thing may fail and the company blows up. Is it rock solid? I mean, it might go up or down, but Tesla's not going away. It'll be as nuts and bolts an investment as Ford or General Motors or something like that.
Well, it is really a stretch for me to make that statement. I will say that their technology's not going away. They have more miles driven in EVs than anybody by a factor of probably 1,000 or 10,000. And that's not hyperbole. That is just factual. Nobody else has the data of how these batteries work in all conditions, about how the car stands up to, you know, the punishment of roads, both, you know, wet roads, snowy roads, potholes, all the rest. The rest of the car manufacturers make cars. These guys are really a computer on wheels. And there is a big difference there. And I think a lot of people, obviously, even though they have nearly $12 billion worth of debt, the stock right now is $449 billion. That's the market cap of the company. So not too many of us would be that concerned with $11 billion in debt when the company's worth this much. That's why we're not that surprised when we see them doing some sort of a share offering, even if it's kind of an odd one that we don't see offered very often.
Talk to me about a couple of other companies. Walmart's in the news today, and any other stocks that catch your eye?
Sure. Well, that Walmart deal, Walmart Plus, basically that is a page from Jeff Bezos, the richest man on earth, from his playbook. With Amazon Prime. Walmart Plus is a yearly subscription that allows you to get all this stuff delivered from the Walmart store to your home with that $98 purchase. So much like Sam's Club and Costco, anything that gets you annual reoccurring revenue is something interesting because it says a lot about the people who are endorsing your offerings. And it obviously is a a list that a lot of people would like to have. People that can afford $98 a year doesn't make you extraordinarily rich. It just means that there are a host of other services that you could imagine selling to those people, John.
Right,
everything
right.
from insurance for your car, for your life, for your home, cable TV, you name it. So many different things that list then becomes a lot more than just somebody who randomly goes into a Walmart occasionally, just like the Amazon with the Amazon Prime.
We don't have another round of stimulus or unemployment supplements right now. Is the data back on how that $600 supplement was spent, and what did we learn from that?
An awful lot of it went right into savings, quite frankly. It was one of the most extraordinary parts of the shutdown, was that a lot of us thought that people would spend the money, and I think, John, they would have spent more money had they had the opportunity. There's only so much you can buy. Granted, there's a diverse offering of things that you can buy from your home. I realize that. But I also realize that it's a bit of a leap for a lot of Americans to buy clothing and so forth without being able to try it on. Whether you call that showrooming, where you go in and try on something and then try to find it online for a better price or something, a lot of that sort of thing just didn't happen during the COVID shutdown because a lot of those stores had limited access. Many of the stores that many of us would like to shop at may have stayed closed for a lot longer. And I think a lot more money, it's not just what I think, I mean, the numbers bear it out, a lot of money went into savings. It was one of the biggest jumps in savings that we've ever seen in America.
Well, that's probably, I mean, I guess you all do with that money what you want, but that doesn't stimulate the economy per se. So by that measure, those dollars weren't successfully spent to sort of spur the economy, were they then?
No, they were not. And like I say, there are two factors here. The one is giving people the money because you've forced them to be at home, and the other is not really giving them a lot of choice as to where they could go. A lot of folks could not go to a restaurant. Some have obviously elected to be part of that 25% crowd that have gone to restaurants in Chicago or in New York that are outdoor dining and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an awful lot of money that, John, just could not be spent, you know, in a reasonable way. Sure, you can always throw money at expensive things or willy-nilly just toss money after something. But I think a lot of Americans were concerned about the lockdowns. What would they mean for how long?
Well, that's
the economy.
It. Maybe,
yeah,
they, maybe,
exactly.
maybe you put it in the bank because you do have another rent payment coming up. So it's not ill spent that way. I did want to ask you about this. Reuters has a story that begins this way. Instant coffee, ketchup, Lululemon yoga pants, and Nike Air Max sneakers are all in. Bottled water, pricey diapers, and Burberry luxury trench coats are out. So coffee, ketchup, and Nike are part of the COVID consumer economy. That's what we were spending our money on, have been spending our money on.
Yep, and that's more understandable, I think, because if you're somebody who is like thousands of us on the lakefront every day, you know, walking, running, riding bikes or whatever, you probably know your shoe size. When it comes to various types of fashion, you want to try on that 42 long or 48 long or whatever sport coat rather than just buy it online.
Yeah.
So I think an awful lot of folks that were comfortable with those condiments that you mentioned, like ketchup and mustard, and they want that for their food at home, as well as Nikes, we can understand why that would be more popular. And the Burberry coats, a lot of that is both aspirational and something that you want to show off to your friends. And if you're sitting around at home, why are you going to be wearing a Burberry coat?
Well, that's it. Wife and I noticed that. I mean, I'll, with this new season, sometimes buy an item or two. I got nowhere to wear it to. Right? Like, did I get a new fall blazer or even a summer suit this year? No, because I got nowhere to go. I didn't buy a tie, for that matter.
Same here. I mean, when I broadcast on CNBC, I've been in shorts since April. These camouflage shorts from you know, whatever, Old Navy. But I, from the top, from the waist up, I look like I'm put together. I have, you know, a nice shirt and tie and jet sport coat and so forth. But an awful lot of people did exactly what you said, John, bought Lululemon. And how many people, especially if a lot of us are going to continue to work from home, are going to go out and buy that Burberry three-piece suit or Brooks Brothers or Hugo Boss or whatever? They're not. They're buying Lululemon, you know, more or less yoga pants and sitting around at home working, but they're not, they don't, you know, again, they're also waist up, you know, when you're on the Zoom calls. By the way, Zoom just exploded higher today. But when you're on those Zoom calls, most people don't see you from the waist down. Zoom is right now up $124 a share. That's 38%
I would give my paycheck to run into John Najarian in an Old Navy store.
Well, you know what? And you wouldn't have, by the way. You would have run into me online because I was buying those online.
You're not wearing shorts now, are you? I promise me you're wearing long pants right now. All right. With information and too much information, John Najarian, the founder of MarketRebellion.com. Thanks for your time, John.
Thank you, guys.
There's a company in Chicago called Vicinity Candles. And like maybe the name would make you think, they'll make scented candles that sort of conjure up the sense of different areas, different vicinities. Vicinity Candles. The founder is Annie Cantera. Annie, you're on WGN Radio. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me today.
You, how long have you guys been in business? How long have you been doing this?
So I just launched in July, so pretty recently.
In the midst of the pandemic?
Yes, in the midst of all of that.
You must have had this on your horizon, though. I mean, somebody doesn't just decide one day to start a whole new business. Was that just the way the timing worked out?
Yeah, so it did help, you know, being home, having more time at home the evenings and the weekends. So, you know, I picked up candle making as a hobby sort of at the beginning in March of all this with the pandemic. And, you know, I really enjoyed it. I was just at first just making it for making candles for friends and family. And then, you know, I started to think about maybe I could turn this into a business. And so, you know, between March and July, I started working on the business model and, you know, working on my inventory. And then, like I said, I launched just in this past July.
So this is something that really did evolve over the course of the pandemic. And it's Vicinity Candles, the idea being that you come up with a scent that represents different neighborhoods. Are you working with just Chicago as your sort of map?
Yeah, so I'm starting with Chicago. You know, I live here right now, and I've been here for 7 years. So I'm definitely most familiar with Chicago. So this is my starting point now. And, you know, it'd be great to expand to other cities in the future. But for now, I'm really focused on Chicago. And there's so many neighborhoods here, so it's definitely given me a lot to focus on.
How many neighborhoods does your inventory represent then?
So right now I just have 8. I launched with 5 at the beginning, and those were all neighborhoods that I was most familiar with. You know, I began with what I know best. So I went to college in Hyde Park at the University of Chicago, so that was a natural choice. And I currently live in Lakeview and have friends in the surrounding areas. So I felt like I had a good grasp on, you know, the different personalities and vibes of those neighborhoods. But recently I launched 3 more, Pilsen, Old Town, and West Loop. And those 3 I had gotten a lot of demand for on my social media and just through user feedback from customers. So that's definitely how I plan to kind of choose the neighborhoods going forward, is based on demand. So just understanding, you know, where customers are looking for candles to represent their neighborhoods.
Hyde Park was built on an old cherry orchard, so it's a cherry-scented candle. Is that right?
That's Andersonville, actually.
Oh, pardon me. Yeah.
So that was, yeah. Yeah, so Hyde Park, I took some inspiration from all of the bookstores and libraries in the area. So kind of chose a scent that was, you know, leather and some patchouli, so kind of a warm scent that's evocative of being in a bookstore.
Yeah, right, or a great old university, right? So I could...
Exactly.
I would guess that for Hyde Park. Then Lakeview. What does Lakeview smell like?
Sure. So Lakeview, you know, I obviously took some inspiration from being right on the lake. So Lakeview smells like kind of rainwater. There's a bit of jasmine and citrus. So a very refreshing scent that's, again, kind of supposed to evoke memories of being on the lake and living so close to Lake Michigan.
I guess if you did Wrigleyville, which is just a block or two west of there, depending on where in Lakeview you are. I mean, I live in Lakeview, but I can hear the ballpark where I live. So if you did a Wrigleyville candle, it would smell like, I don't know, beer and hot dogs, right? Or leather, maybe the leather of a baseball glove.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to draw inspiration. Wrigleyville is definitely on my list. You know, popcorn, there's so many things to draw inspiration from there.
Yeah.
So I kind of try to take a bit from, you know, both the history of the neighborhood and also kind of the current vibe and how the current residents have shaped it.
You know, it's easy to get silly about this and say, well, you could do the Stockyards, or you could do automotive exhaust, or you could do some other unpleasant smells in a neighborhood. You're not going to go that direction, are you?
No, I don't think so. I've definitely, you know, I've tried to pick some scents that are, you know, still pleasant and would be nice in the home, but have a bit of the inspiration in there as well. You know, I could definitely throw in a couple of notes of some of those things as well, but
don't.
Would like the, yeah.
give me another neighborhood. Yeah. Give me the representative scent then.
Another neighborhood?
And the representative scent. So give me another candle that you do.
Cool. Sure. So like I said, there was a lot of demand for Old Town. So that one, there was some interesting history. I was looking into it, and it turns out it was, you know, the Midwestern hub of Yippie County culture. So kind of the counterculture that was led by Abby Hoffman, the political activist. So it was kind of very, you know, kind of a hippie vibe of the neighborhood. And that was something I hadn't known about Old Town. You know, I definitely think of the Old Town Art Festival and definitely it being a hub for arts and culture, but that was an interesting fact that I learned as I was doing the research. So for Old Town, then I ended up doing patchouli, you know, a little bit of patchouli for the hippie sort of vibe and some blackberry and amber. So it's a really warm, fruity scent.
How do you assimilate the smell of marijuana in a candle? I guess that would be a way to do
it, too. Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, there's another project for you. They're called Vicinity Candles. And Annie Cantera is the founder. VicinityCandles.com. Visit VicinityCandles.com. Fascinating, and I think you're in a good space. Good luck. Right time, right place, actually. I think people are spending more time nesting inside, and candles are part of that environment. So I think you're in a good spot, Annie.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
Act 12:35 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm reading from a story in the Washington Post. The average weekly unemployment payment now is just over $300, and many people get less. Republican and Democratic leaders have barely spoken in the past 2 weeks. Co-authoring this story, Congress Left Town and Left Jobless Benefits Lapse, is Heather Long, who writes about the economic scene for the Washington Post. Heather, welcome back to WGN Radio.
Hey, good to be here. Thank you.
We had Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy on a little while ago, and, you know, we put these people on and we say, why did you guys leave town without doing it, and what are you going to do when you get back? And to be honest with you, I didn't hear a lot of hope in his voice that this was going to be resolved quickly when they do return.
I have the same not-so-rosy outlook. It's clear we still have 27 million Americans who are on unemployment payments right now. Some of them have actually gone back to work, but like in our story, we feature a woman who works at a casino in Gulfport, Mississippi, and she's like, look, I went back to work in July. The problem is, you know, there aren't many customers at restaurants and casinos right now. And she said, so I only get half the hours. She's lucky if she gets like 15 hours. The checks are less. You know, people aren't tipping as much. There aren't many customers. And so she still gets a little bit of unemployment money. But, you know, she was telling me when I talked to her, like, she's taking out a loan on her car to try to pay her September rent. And we heard stories like that over and over again. The unemployment payments in the country at the end of July, the average was just over $900 a week, which is pretty good. But then in August, without the congressional action, that fell to just over $300 a week. And, you know, you just do the basic math, you know, 3 weeks at $300, you know, barely $1,200 a month. That's hard to pay for rent in places like Chicago or where I'm sitting in Washington, D.C., let alone buy food or medicine or back-to-school stuff for the kids.
Is that the problem, that it was too much? you didn't say that, and I'm not even saying that, but $900 a week and people can get along with. And that's the criticism that Republicans have. They want it to be a third of that.
Oh, that's right. Or and they wanted 200 instead of there was so the way it works is there's a state payment which is the $300 roughly, and it varies by state and by person, but I'm talking about averages. And then the Congress had put in place an extra $600. Some people call it a bonus, a federal bonus, through the end of July. And, you know, look, there's no doubt about it. Over half the people on unemployment were making more money on unemployed than they had in their prior job. Obviously, we did that because a lot of people didn't, you know, we didn't want people going back to work during a pandemic when things were unsafe. But the reality is, I keep reminding people, like, at the moment, there are fewer than 6 million job openings for 27 million unemployed people, or people on unemployment insurance. So, you know, yes, we want people to get back to work if it's safe and they can do that, but there just aren't enough job openings. You know, the obvious compromise, Democrats wanted to keep the $600 bonus. Republicans had pitched the $200 bonus, much, much smaller. Now, the obvious compromise was something around $400, and many economists were urging that. But the Republicans didn't want to go that high, the Senate Republicans, and Democrats didn't want to go that low. And so here we are with no extra money at all.
So I asked the congressman, how about it just every week renew some sort of stopgap thing? And I think that was a Republican plan, and he said it would be so difficult for the states to actually do that every week or every month, another funding mechanism. Is that a valid sort of criticism of the Republican idea to just do continuations of stopgap bills?
Well, I think the real problem is the election's coming up, and we all, you know, the reality of D.C. is that stopgap might have worked for August. That might have been the solution for August, but it's not going to be the solution for September, October, November as we head into the election, the key election season. Republicans and Democrats are not, you know, if they can't even come and do it in August, they're not going to come back every month and keep renewing. So I think there's sort of a political reality check there to what's going on. But, you know, we talk a lot about the unemployed, and their crises are real with these evictions starting again in many parts of the country, particularly September rent. It's really hard from a lot of people we were talking to. But this is also a small business issue. A number of small businesses are really, you know, that PPP money, the government grants and loans, have now run out as well. And a lot of small businesses are also on the verge of closing forever. So, and we see airlines already saying they're going to make some big layoffs. I know that affects Chicago. It is a big airline hub.
Yep.
And so, you know, the reality is real that September, already things are not very pretty, but September, the pain is going to get deeper.
Didn't Mark Meadows meet with Nancy Pelosi? I mean, the Congress isn't in session, but it doesn't mean they can't lay out a plan. What happened there?
There have been some meetings and calls between Mark Meadows and House Speaker Pelosi, also Secretary Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary. But at the moment, both sides are blaming each other. They come off these calls and they go on TV and they blame the other side for the breakdowns. Nancy Pelosi even pretended sort of mockingly that she didn't remember Mark Meadows' name. So if you're at that phase where you're pretending you don't even remember your fellow negotiator's name, then that tells you how far apart things are right now. And it's pretty shocking. I think if you ask people like me who sit here and cover Congress and the White House at the beginning of August, will we have a deal? I think we all thought, yeah, that there was a pretty good chance we would have a deal by mid-August. And to be sitting here on September 1st, and literally most of us now think it's more like a 50-50 shot, are we going to have a deal by the end of September? And I think, you know, that this is a real gamble. It's a real gamble for President Trump as he seeks re-election. Without this extra relief, help for these small businesses, help for people who are unemployed, the things can deteriorate pretty quickly in the economy this month.
Heather, is there a short answer to whose heels are dug in the most? I mean, you want 600, you want 200, it's 400. Who's dragging their heels on that? That's an issue.
Yeah, I will say Senate Republicans. And in our article, it's interesting. A lot of unemployed are obviously following the news very closely. I was really impressed by how much people are reading. You know, the White House, to their credit, in early August, did put forward a proposal to Democrats of a $400 compromise, you know, like what you're laying out. Okay, let's just cut the difference, do 400 and move on. And, you know, I have to say Democrats sort of said no at that point. But it's really been the Senate Republicans who say that they're not sure they could get on board. So I keep watching. I keep watching Secretary Mnuchin. He brokered the big deal back in March, and so unfortunately, he wasn't sounding very optimistic this morning.
Heather Long co-authored the story. Congress left town and let jobless benefits lapse. Unemployed Americans say they won't forget it. It's in the Washington Post today. You can read it online. Thanks for your time, Heather.
Thank you. Bye.
It's 12:43 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Back into the WGN Radio Newsroom. Steve Bertrand with some business news.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. More than 50 black former McDonald's franchise owners are suing the Chicago-based company. They say the company steered them to less profitable restaurants and didn't give them the same support and opportunities that they gave white franchisees. GoGo is a Chicago-based company that provides in-flight internet access to airlines, but we know people just aren't flying these days and business has been tough. It's selling that part of its business to Intelstat for $400 million. GoGo furloughed 600 workers in April and said July 30th that it would cut 143 jobs. But there is some happier music. Reverb is a Chicago company that sells musical instruments, and Crane says it reported its highest quarterly gross sales ever in the last quarter. Turns out a lot of us have been staying home and learning to play the guitar. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
On to the agribusiness scene. Here is Orion Samuelson.
And it's a green screen in the grain market at the Board of Trade at the moment. The September wheat contract is up 13¾ cents a bushel. September corn is up 0.75 cents. And the September soybean contract is trading up 2¾ cents a bushel. Livestock futures, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, October lean hogs trading higher, up $1.42 a hundredweight. October live cattle up 35 cents a hundredweight, and October feeder cattle up 7 cents a hundredweight. The weekly crop condition reports came out yesterday afternoon from USDA, and as we look at our Midwest states, Wisconsin is the far and away garden state of the Midwest. 80% of the corn crop in Wisconsin, 82% of the soybean crop in Wisconsin, rated good to excellent. Compare that to Iowa, who suffered the derecho a couple of weeks ago. Only 45% of the Iowa corn crop rated good to excellent, 50% of the soybean crop. And in Illinois, 72% of the soybean crop rated good to excellent, 70% of the Illinois crop reported good to excellent for the corn crop. The cancellations and the postponements and the virtual technology activity continue. Willie Nelson, John Mellencamp, Neil Young, and Dave Matthews will headline the Farm Aid 2020 on the road alongside family farmers from across the country. It'll all be done virtually. It's the 35th anniversary of the get-together by the celebrities who formed Farm Aid, and so it will take place on Saturday, September 26th from 8 to 11 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, and we'll let you know where you can find it on your virtual technology TV set. And we might also mention that normally we'd be getting ready to go to the Sandwich Fair next week. We won't this year because the COVID-19 situation has postponed the Sandwich Fair for a year, as has been the case with most other county and state fairs so far this year. And just received word from the National Outstanding Young Farmer Program that normally meets in February, and they will, but it'll be virtual this next year as they come together for their annual get-together to pick the nation's outstanding young farmers. Pretty much the story of all of the summertime festivals, county and state fairs so far this year. That's your money on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hi, Amy.
Hey, John. How are you today?
I'm good. Walmart unveils a subscription service, right?
That's right. Yeah. So this is part of that e-commerce conversation that we have been having for quite a while now. But essentially, they're trying to compete with Amazon Prime, which, as I'm sure many people know, you sign up and you get a little bit better deal if you're ordering something off of Amazon. You can often get it faster. You get free shipping with no minimum purchase. A lot of that is fueling some of the real estate, grabs that we've talked about lately here locally that Amazon has done. But Walmart has been really in that space and really trying to build their e-commerce business. So they have launched a Walmart Plus. It is a $98 a year membership plan. You have to get $35 worth of stuff to get that free shipping. So there's a couple of things where I think they probably will see some things they need to catch up to Amazon Prime, to do. But I think kind of the big point of it is, the big selling point is that it's close to stores. There's a really interesting piece of data that CNN had, and that is about 90% of Americans live within 10 miles of a Walmart. So the fact that so many of these stores can ship items on the same day may help beat speed. And that is the whole thing that Amazon, because they're investing in these areas, Walmart may be able to do it even faster because they're taking things right out of the stores. So this is really interesting. I think it'd be really interesting to watch what Amazon then does to try to one up this even more. But it seems a bit like, okay, the battle, has been launched here to see between these two e-commerce giants. Walmart is no small thing. It really has been reporting some really large numbers. So I think this is going to be really interesting to watch.
Will people be buying groceries this way?
Yeah, Walmart, think about all the stuff that's in a Walmart, there's so much stuff there. So I think that's going to be really interesting to watch, because people have been shifting more to buying groceries online who maybe were on the fence about doing so before. Walmart has a huge grocery business, and while you're there, you can buy tires. There's so much stuff there. So I think it's going to be interesting. Walmart also last week said that it had partnered with Microsoft to make a bid to buy TikTok, the video app. So it seems like Walmart is suddenly kind of doubling down and trying to build out lots of areas of its business. So I think Walmart is going to be a really interesting company to watch. Just watch how their strategy is playing out and see what their next move is over the next year or so.
Amy, John DeJarian a little while ago talked about Zoom, but just for a half a sentence. What's happening with Zoom today?
Well, this is probably not a huge surprise, but really colossal numbers when we're looking at this year that Zoom has had. Obviously, so many people are using Zoom to communicate with people, and businesses are running on it. I mean, so much is happening on Zoom right now that people are even talking about having Zoom fatigue, right? So Zoom finished its fiscal second quarter with 370,000+ customers, up from just a year ago that had 66,000 customers. So that's a really big jump. But when we're looking at money, they earned about $186 million, which is about 66 cents per share during the last quarter, which is up $5.5 million from the same period about a year ago. So that's a really big jump for this company. They had kind of warned they expected to see a drop by now, thinking, oh, we'll just be, sheltering in place at home for a little while and then everyone's going to go back to work. But as we've seen that really we're starting to see some bigger shifts and some companies are questioning, do we really need this much office when people can telecommute, things like that. Maybe meetings can be over Zoom and we don't need to fly anywhere. They're still seeing these really big numbers. So, again, another company I think is going to be really interesting to watch. Now that they're a much bigger part of our lives than they were, even 8 months ago.
Yeah, 5 months ago, 4 months ago. It's funny you mentioned a few hundred thousand customers versus 66,000 customers a year ago. So that's considerable growth. I'm surprised it's not even more, 370,000 customers. But I've used Zoom many times, and I don't know that I am considered a customer. I've never paid for a Zoom service or subscription. I've used a free version of it. So
yeah.
I don't think that captures the number of users or amount of use it's getting.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So they're talking about people that go, you know what, I do want those extra capabilities. I want to be able to record the meeting to look back on it instead of taking notes. I do want to be able to, you know, do all these extra things. And I think a big piece that helped bump that up was when they started offering that encryption. Because if you recall a few months ago, there was a little bit of consternation about Zoom bombing, and people were accessing meetings, and it wasn't encrypted, and people were worried about privacy, and rightly so. So they offered, hey, well, if you give us, you know, whatever it is a month, this low monthly fee, I think it's about $10 or $15, then we'll give you those privacy controls. We'll give you an encrypted ability to meet. We'll let you have a waiting room and kick people out and vet them before they even enter. And I think that really appealed to a lot of people. So that move seemed like it drove a lot of subscribers. But I think that's going to be interesting to watch, because surely anytime there's a big need, there's copycats, right? So yeah. I think we're going to, yeah. you know, and Microsoft has a product that's similar. But I think we're going to see a lot more features coming from them. That's really just kind of a speculation and a hunch there. But as more and more businesses are leaning on it in a much more serious way and thinking not as, oh, this is a stopgap until we all come back to work, and thinking instead now as like, okay, this is part of our strategy. This is part of how we communicate and how we do our work. Mm-hmm. I think Zoom is going to probably respond to that pretty soon.
Yeah, I like it when they do kick us out after 40 minutes, because then I'm not going to buy the service, because I can just say, the thing's over. Goodbye.
I know.
This is our conversation right now. We're out of time. But, Amy, thanks for your reporting on that.
Thanks so much, John.
Amy Guth.